Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Your Book Sack. I am here with Holden Shepherd, who has taken some time out of his day to talk to us about The Brink, which I've got in my hands. If you're watching this video or, you know, staring at the front cover, perhaps you've got it too. Thank you, Holden, for joining me.
G'day, Emma. Thank you very much for having me here. It's a pleasure.
It is by the magic of Zoom that we've been able to make this happen. Of course, Holden's in Perth and I'm here in Victoria, and I have been thinking about The Brink, and I've been thinking about Invisible Boys, and I've been thinking about these two texts of yours, Holden, for on my mind recently. Like I said to you before, I saw you at the Wheeler Centre, but I feel like I had some colleagues back in my Tasmanian teaching days in 2019 who were raving about Invisible Boys, and I must admit, I'm late to the Holden Shepherd fan party. Like, I've only just arrived.
That's okay. I mean, better late than never, right?
Right, exactly. I've only just got here, and I tore through both your books in the one weekend, actually. And I really quite enjoyed them, and I thought they were made an interesting contrast to have read them so close together, actually, without the break, you know, the publishing break in between, given that I was late to the joint. But I wondered, we're here to talk about The Brink, and I'm sure we'll find some time to catch up on Invisible Boys too. But I was looking at the back cover of The Brink actually just before, and I noticed, obviously, you've got some really lovely, you know, comments that people have made about The Brink, which is, we're not saying that because I'm surprised or anything, but I'm wondering, we've got explosive, dark, gritty, a ride you'll never forget, thrilling, edge of your seat read, and on the front, raw, exhilarating, and emotionally charged, absolute must read. And I'm wondering, what are the adjectives you would use to describe The Brink? How would you describe it if you were writing your own jacket cover?
Oh, you know, the best book in the world. I would be more humble, maybe. Yeah. I think some of the words are the same. I think I would use, I often use the word raw. Like, yeah. I think what I write is very raw. It's honest. Mm-hmm. It's vulnerable. I like the word exorcism. You know, like at both books I've written, and everything I tend to do tends to be this emotional release. There is a catharsis that comes with it. And as much as my characters are exercising their own demons, I feel like I am as well as I write it. So exorcism is a cool one. And someone once referred to my work as muscular. And I thought, it just on like 20 different levels, what a cool word, what a cool adjective to describe the way I write and the tone and the voice and all
that. And sort of how it all works together. If you like, I'm imagining like a body, and it's sort of doing all of its parts and flexing them and doing what the body does. I mean, that's the extent of my body knowledge, my muscle knowledge. But, you know, you're a gym bloke. That seems like something that you seems quite fitting, actually, that choice, that word.
Yeah, it was on brand. When someone said it to me, and I was like, I'm going to use that forever. Yeah. And I think the one I love, actually, Nigel Featherstone referred to my writing. I think he did it in person when we did an event and he interviewed me, but also I think he wrote a, you know, a little thing about my book as a review for The Brink, and he said, this is fearless writing. And I thought, oh man, that's what I aspire to. That's what I try to throw all the fear away when I write. When I'm creating, it's forget, or, you know, feel the fear and do it anyway to some extent, but throw it all away. And so being described as a fearless writer, that made me very proud, more than just about anything that people have said about my work.
That is such a great compliment, actually, to be referred to like that, because there was a sense of, I felt, with Brink, not to say about Invisible Boys, but a real sense of, like, I am understanding that this is territory that is confronting for some people, and I'm happy to be vulnerable, and I'm stepping into it, and I'm possibly terrified, but I'm covering it anyway, and get on board and come for the ride and learn something, or not. It's totally up to you. We can be in it together. So that's a lovely, what a nice thing for him to have said to you about your writing.
I was well chuffed. Yeah, that's one of my favorite kind of adjectives that people have used for my writing.
Yeah, that's lovely. I'm wondering how you became this fearless writer, and sort of how you got here. I often like to ask my guests that I interview about what they read when they were a student or when they were at school, if they were into writing or even into reading. Were there any texts that you can think of that really helped you, you know, decide you were going to pursue this career in writing, or any texts you remember that you just really loved as a young person? I can see Harry Potter on your bookshelf behind you, so I'm going to show you.
You know, that was my era. You know, I really grew up. And actually, I grew up, you know, I was a little, I could be a little prick sometimes. I remember someone in, it must have been year seven, and we had silent reading.
Yeah.
And, you know, my mate, Alex, I shouldn't name him, but he was reading, you know, Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire had just come out, right? And it was, Harry Potter was a thing, but it hadn't yet become like
the thing.
Everyone, it was right about that time that it became the thing that everyone read. And so it was the year 2000. And he's reading this thing, and I was making fun of it, and I was going, ooh, you know, wizards and, you know, like Harry Pothead, ha, ha, ha. Like, you know, I don't even know what Pothead meant. I was, you know, 12.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point we had to swap books with the person that we were doing silent, you know, like whoever was at the table, you know, swap books and read their book for a day. And so anyway, I had to read this Harry Potter. And I start, you know, the first chapter of The Goblet of Fire, which is this, you know, the Riddle House or whatever it is, you know.
Yeah, actually.
It's backstory. And I remember going, oh, my God. You know, like I'm 11 or 12 and I'm going, this is dark and this is like full on. I loved it. And then I just got absolutely, enraptured in that whole world. So those books were my thing.
Yep.
And even things like Tomorrow When the War Began, the Tomorrow series by John Marsden, were massively influential. Mm-hmm. I think as well because John Marsden has had a lot of, in his younger days at least, he had a lot of mental health stuff, and it comes through the way he writes, the way he understands human beings and empathy and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So those books, you know, those two series probably really influenced me. You can't quite see, but next to the Harry Potter series is the Tomorrow series.
Ah.
So they're on the top shelf because they're so important to me. And the other one is probably The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho.
It was
a parable about following your dreams. Mm-hmm. And my year 12 geography teacher kind of thrust it into my hands and was like, you've got to read this, you'll love it. And I did. And it made me drop geography, actually. So he was quite upset because I realized that I needed more time to write. But that book is what made me pursue, what made me believe that as this little, you know, working class boy from Geraldton in the Midwest, I could be a writer, you know, like I could believe in finding my treasure like Santiago in The Alchemist.
The Alchemist, yeah.
That was quite influential.
And that's, I'm impressed that as a, you know, as a year 11 student or whatever, you were able to get through The Alchemist. I read that not long ago, or maybe a couple of years ago now, and I feel like I paused and then I took several months away and I came back and was even more confused than what I was when I So I'm impressed you could just, understand the quite like rich allegory of that story. In year 11, that's your props on your geography teacher. I think teachers sometimes often have that way, right, where they can pick up on your interests or something that might be, you know, a little passion for you and really fuel it for you. So,
It was quite a nice little, it was quite a nice moment. I'm trying to find the right word and I can't, but it kind of almost like it was meant to be.
Yeah, sure.
Because I was doing geography because I'd had this lifelong interest in maps.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be like a little town planner when I was a kid.
Interesting.
I was doing geography, but I'd also loved writing.
Yeah.
And I just thought, well, town planning is an actual job and writing isn't an actual job.
Mm-hmm.
And I just always thought it was really interesting that it was the geography teacher right at the end of high school who was kind of like, read this. And I was like, this has decided it for me. I'm going to pivot and I'm going to be a writer. You know, I just thought it was interesting that the maps led me to the point of
the writing. So how do we get from Harry Potter and Tomorrow When the War Begins, you know, the collection of stories by John Marsden, to The Brink? What happens in your thinking, your writing process, you know, your life? Obviously you've got Invisible Boys and other stuff that you're working on or whatever. How do you get from there to there?
I mean, it's a very long, convoluted tale, and I'll have to find a short way of, you know, a pithy way of answering it. But probably the easiest explanation is I went to uni, and that shifted me slightly into where I was going. So when I was reading those kind of texts in high school, I was mostly writing action adventure, Pokemon fan fiction. I love Matthew Riley. You know, I didn't read stuff that was particularly gritty or emotional or dark.
Yeah.
And I went to uni and I was, you know, the first year I was taught all this kind of very literary stuff, and I didn't love it. You know, there was some that I liked and some that I hated, but it was dense literary stuff. And I just remember having this really strong reaction to it in my assignments, in my journal that we had to give to the lecturer. And at the end of the first year, I'll never be able to thank this particular lecturer enough for what she did, because she could have got there and seen all my angry, you know, 19-year-old writing about how much I hate postmodernism and how much I hate, you know, this and that. And she could have just gone, fail, you suck, you're not, you have the wrong attitude, whatever. And instead she went, it's fine if you don't like some texts. It's fine if you don't like some trends in literature. All of that's okay. You can actually express that, but I need you to interrogate your anger. Why do you feel this way? And then tell me what you do like.
Yeah.
And that to me was a complete revolution for my writing forever, because I just thought that if you're taught something at uni, you have to agree with it. Right. You know, if they say, here's this thing, you have to go, this is great.
Mm-hmm.
And it opened up the permission for me to go, oh, okay, well, I like this part of, you know, it made me a much better learner and a much better writer, because I could kind of be like, okay, right, well, I don't completely love this thing, but I do like that part. I do understand this part, and this part might be really useful. And aesthetically, I really like what that one did. You know, that poem was cool. So I could become a much better learner, and I started to learn how to integrate myself into this stuff. So from that point on, I started writing more from first person and more, instead of writing action adventure and made up kind of stuff. I started writing, you know, the first short story I wrote after that interaction with my lecturer was called A Man. And it was based on, it was a laborer, you know, digging trenches in earth moving and in Geraldton. But that's what I did that summer. You know, I was writing myself onto a page.
Yeah.
And that one is the first thing I ever had published. It got published in a journal over in WA called Indigo. And that started everything off. Like that set the tone for me talking about masculinity, talking about sex and sexuality and confronting bad mental health and just opening all of that up.
Yeah.
So that's probably the bridge. And then the further along I went, I did my degree, I did my honours year. I got further and further towards wanting to write about sex and homosexuality and to not hold back, so that degree gave me a lot of freedom.
To be able to actually do that and put that into your work. And I think there's a real sense of, I read a lot of YA and middle grade fiction for work, but also to, you know, to be able to recommend to people and whatever. And there was there's definitely a tone, a fearlessness. There's like a sense of something that comes across in your books that I don't get in the others. And I don't know how to quite articulate what it is, but it's like it's frank and it's raw and it's honest. And, you know, I feel like, I mean, I don't know you, but I feel like I was reading about you and I could feel that catharsis that you spoke about earlier, like on the page in terms of grappling with all of the stuff. And, you know, I noticed in the brink in your acknowledgements, I'm like one of those people that reads what the authors have to say at the end. I don't know if people do that, but I do.
I love that. I love that people do that. Yeah.
Who's helped this young person on their journey? But you know, you had said that this was a book that you would have loved to have read as a teenage boy. And I thought, yeah, I've taught boys before. And I think absolutely there's so much in it. Have them critique or have them empathize with that maybe they don't get in other fiction pieces, perhaps. Yeah. I don't think I've got any questions about that. I just want to say that out loud. But
well, I'm happy to kind of talk to it, because it is something I'm interested in and I'm proud of these books doing.
Yes.
When I was the same day I did that Wheeler Centre event in Melbourne, I did one at North Fitzroy Library.
Yep.
And someone, you know, one of the library staff kind of commented, like, I've never seen so many males in the audience for a library gig.
Yeah.
And I was like, cool. Like, that's
great.
I'm really happy about that, that I'm speaking to a new audience who doesn't usually come to the library and doesn't usually read. And that's what I get a lot of. You know, I get a lot of people on Twitter and Instagram, especially, who come across me in some context and then end up reading and they go, I've not read since high school. I don't like reading, but this seemed like it would reflect what I went through at high school.
Yeah.
And I would have loved to have read stuff that, I just come in with this really blank slate around masculinity that I don't often see in other texts. I think there's generally a starting point assumption that, you know, we've got to fix teenage boys in some way.
Yeah.
And my starting point is like, well, they're fine. And let's see what we can explore. And I'm not saying every behavior in the world is fine. That's absolutely not what I'm saying. And, you know, you can read the brink and you can kind of see that there's, you know, especially people like Jared and Ryan are really violent and angry and that leads them into bad places. But I don't want to be super didactic about, you know, this is how you have to be. I just want to kind of show it. I feel like my job as an artist is just to put it on the page and trust the reader and trust teenage readers to be mature enough to look at that and go, wow, that guy's not a great guy.
Yeah.
Or, you know, he's an okay guy, but wow, he's done some really messed up stuff.
Exactly. And I think, you know, and I mean this, I don't want this to sound like offensive in any way, and that's certainly not how I mean this to come across, if it does, and I apologize, but I feel like I see you and I don't think that guy's a writer. I don't think you are not playing into the stereotype, but I think students have a certain perception about what a writer looks like or what a writer does. And it's, you know, maybe it's slaving over their laptop 24/7 or prepare, and they might look a certain way. And I suppose, you know, you aren't slaving over your laptop 24/7, I presume, no lights on, you know, over your desk computer or whatever. You're out living your life, you're, you know, doing your thing, you're on active on social media, you're doing all that kind of stuff, and you are like a buff dude. And maybe that's also helping the cause too, in that, you know, where writers can be anybody, everyone's experiences are valid and everyone's stories are important. And here we are in all our different shapes and sizes and talking about our work.
I don't find that offensive at all. It's made me feel like a misfit for a long time, but I'm a bit Popeye about it. I'm like, I am who I am, you know, like there was a time where I really tried to, or I was trying to, you know, like I'd go to literary events and I would feel like I'm such an outsider and I don't belong and why am I not like these people? But there was also just this real stubbornness within me that I was like, I could see other people around me kind of mold themselves into what they think a writer should act like or how a writer should be. And they do that. And I was kind of watching and I was just so stubborn about like, no, like I'm just going to be exactly myself. And if that's not good enough, then I guess I don't make it. But I didn't want to compromise that.
Yeah.
And so I am a little bit proud of that because people kind of throw me in the diversity bucket because of my sexuality, which is fine. I'm really proud to rep that as well. But I think the bigger response I get, say, from school kids is that I'm this bogan dude from a country town and I also made it as a writer.
Yeah.
I did a talk for Book Week to a bunch of year sixes, which was wild to me because they can't read my book, right? So I could barely mention my books existing. I was kind of like, here's my books. You can read them when you're older. Let's talk about writing.
Yeah.
And do a writing workshop. But the really cool thing, the feedback from the teacher was that she had one of her boys in that year six class who's always gone, I'm going to play footy. That's what I want to do with my life. I want to play footy.
Yeah.
And he's turned around the next day and gone, oh, I'm going to play footy and I'm going to write.
Nice.
And I just thought, that's, you know, because I was chatting with these year six boys about, I go for Collingwood and they were going for the Eagles and we were just having a chat about that. But it's a nice thing to feel like I can open that space up for kids who otherwise feel like maybe they don't belong.
Exactly. And I think so. And it's nice to, I mean, I really like am loath to bring up sort of gender stereotypical roles or anything like that. But I feel like for a sporty boy to see another, you know, man that they can relate to in a field that might be like highly feminized maybe or perceived to be like quite feminine in its, you know, pursuits of writing, that is. I think that's cool. I think that's really cool. Yeah.
I really value what you just said because that is how it comes across to young boys.
Yep.
They look at writing or creativity or English books, you know, and at some age, I mean, boys are still readers, but at some age they kind of go, oh, that's girly or that's feminine or that's soft, so I'm just going to detach from that. And I think it is a problem. I think it's something that we haven't cracked that nut yet.
Yeah.
I'd like to think that I can help with that.
And just kind of be like,
you can be both. You know, really can be both.
Let's talk about the inspiration for The Brink, which I want to know, first and foremost, so it's about leavers, school leavers leaving year 12. They're finishing up for their time in WA, set in WA on the coast. But I want to know where the inspiration came from, and I would like to know, if I can pry into your personal life, what you did when you left Year 12 to celebrate your leavers. the events of yours were inspired.
I can confirm there were no one got stabbed or glassed or poisoned on my leavers trip, to my knowledge. But there is a little bit of a link, only in that in my leavers year. So we came from Jero, and you know, we previous years had gone to Kalbarri, which is a little town on the beach 2 hours north, and previous leavers had kind of made a mess of the town, and they weren't very respectful.
Okay.
So Kalbarri was like, leavers, leave us alone.
Yep.
So we had to go 2 hours south to Durian Bay, which is where the leavers in this book actually start off. They're heading to Durian Bay, which is what we were doing. Our year, not me personally, but our year's leavers also kind of trashed Durian Bay a little bit. To the point, to the point where it was like, we're not having leavers anymore. Or schoolies, as you guys would say.
Yes.
In Victoria. So like, we're not having schoolies anymore. So that's that literally happened. And so that's why at the start of this book, the police basically turn this group of leavers, you know, my main characters in the brink, and they go, Durian Bay is not accepting leavers. You have to go somewhere else, because that is what happened. It didn't happen that kind of spontaneously, of course, but, you know, a book, you've got to kind of amp up the tension.
Well, that's it. You've got to.
But, yeah, no, so our leavers was relatively tame compared to this. We did a lot of, a lot of drinking, a lot of beach cricket, a lot of I'm half Italian, so we I had cutlets. I had frozen cutlets from, you know, my parents to serve for everyone, and I had ouzo instead of instead of beer. I didn't drink beer when I was younger. I used
just
to drink
straight to the ouzo.
Straight to ouzo and wild turkey bourbon.
You poor thing.
I loved it. I didn't really know any better. That was just the drink. My dad used to drink ouzo and Coke.
Sure.
And so I was like, well, I want to be like dad.
Yeah.
Which, if you know, you've read The Brink, so Leonardo's story, there is a bit of me in that.
I thought I'd maybe channel some of the energy from the Brink, sorry, minus some of the drama, but like, you know,
enthusiasm. There's a lot of drama in this book. I don't know how much you want to channel into.
Well, I was going to bring that up actually, because I really felt like I really feel like the twist in the story with the two. I mean, I feel like people should expect there's going to be spoilers, right? But the two people who die in the book took me by surprise. I don't know if I just sort of forget when I'm reading that I've got to also think about how the dots are connecting, or whether I'm just sort of passively consuming stuff. I don't know. This happens to me often. All of a sudden something happens and I think, whoa, I had no idea. So I had no idea that either of those things were going to happen until they had happened. And I thought, oh my God, there's so much drama on one weekend, like 6 days or whatever it is, for them to be away. There's a lot going on in this book. Heaps. I was just going to say, how do you decide what to include, and how do you make sure all your drama it's not competing? You know, you want to tie everything up at the end. How do you decide what gets to stay and what has to go?
Yeah, editors help a lot with that. and this book particularly, there's been so many versions of it where it was. This is the first thing I started writing after uni. So, like, the first time I kind of sat down, I was like, I'm going to write a book that's going to get published.
Yeah, right.
This was the very beginning thing. Mm-hmm. However, it was very different. So it started off as this action adventure. A bus explodes at a servo in the middle of the country. Five characters flee in a hail of bullets. Like, it was crazy shit. You know, like, it was crazy stuff. Sorry, I'm on a podcast. It was wild, and it was just like an action adventure, Matthew Riley-esque kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the five characters who had escaped this situation were early versions of Leonardo, Kaya, Mason, Jared, and Valentina.
Yep.
And so they remained. So I kept rewriting this. I just had this thing of these five people who'd been thrown together and weren't really friends and didn't really like each other.
Yeah.
And so it kept evolving. There was a thriller version. There was a version where it was kind of almost gothic, and there was like there's a nurse on the island, Teresa, who has a very tiny role now.
Yeah, yeah.
But in the earlier draft, she was like the Machete Max of the piece. She was like the evil and she was an ex-surgeon and she was evil and killing people. And, you know, like there's been a lot of just wild versions of this book that would not have worked. You know, like they just would not have gotten published. So I was learning how to write a book as I wrote this book.
You know? Yeah.
And eventually it got to the point of, you know, this is not just a thriller, this is also a coming-of-age story. So I pulled out a lot of the murdery elements and a lot of the thriller elements. It was more of a thriller before than it is now.
Okay. Yeah.
There were more, you know, there were more bodies.
Yeah, right. Well, oh, far out. I'm not sure I could have coped.
Well, and that's the thing. When it's contemporary, more than two bodies would have started to feel like a thriller, like a straight up thriller.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, my agent and my publisher weighing in and helping me shape this to make it fit the genre.
Make it fit a little bit more. Is it really, I really enjoyed, I've got a lot of notes here of things that I want to talk to you about, but I want to ask firstly, so we've got the growth, the change, the identity, all of those characters sort of grappling with who they are and what they want to be and where they want to go. And I liked that they were put in a situation where they all kind of really didn't like each other, because I think school is like that for a lot of people. And you sort of, I mean, I felt like that when I was at school sometimes, and just here in simply enduring and tolerating these people, my peers at school, and to have to spend then like forced socialization time with them. I really connected with the characters that felt like that in the novel. And just sort of like wanting to be the whole thing to be over so I could close the door on that time and get to the next bit of my life. I really connected with those characters. I think students will too, particularly those that are maybe school's not their place, right, which is how it is for some kids. Like not everyone has a great time at school. Not everyone loves being there. Not everyone likes learning. Not everyone likes the people that they're forced to spend time with. And I liked that notion that they're quite literally on the brink of change or of something. Like they're on the brink of disaster and murder and stuff, but they're also on the brink of like the next bit of their life. What extent of that is like you deliberately crafting the narrative, choosing the title and putting it all together? And how much of that is just like, for lack of a better expression, just dumb luck? It all just worked out that way.
Yeah. There was a fair bit of deliberate kind of crafting, but the title was originally Leavers, so it was just called Leavers. Mm-hmm. And my agent kind of suggested, you know, it's not the best title. See if you can find a better one. And she came up. I had a 100 titles with the versions of the word the brick. And eventually she's like, just go with the brink. You know, that's perfect. And I was like, yeah, you're right, because it does. It sums up the literal setting. You know, they're on Brink Island. It sums up the situation that they're put in, which pushes them each to the brink of their limits. And, you know, thirdly, as you say, they're on the edge of adulthood. They're on the edge of the next phase of life. So they're on the brink of that. So that was chosen because it was a triple whammy title and it worked really, really well. But, yeah, the way I crafted the book, kind of without throwing in too many spoilers, but I wanted to see it as, so they spend 5 days on the island because that's like a school week, and then school ends, and then the weekend represents freedom and adulthood and the next step. So the 5 days and the island were kind of this representation of high school and how much of a pressure cooker that environment is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when they finally get out of there, it is the Saturday. It's the weekend, and they're now adults. They're grown up. They can be themselves at last. But yeah, what you were describing about, you know, kids at school, like being a misfit, or, you know, I was probably most like Leonardo at high school.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of, I think the sad part of Leonardo and or me is that you end up in these situations where you kind of fool yourself that you really want, you're like, you really want these people to like you and you really want to be included. But there is a deeper part of you. You know, what Leonardo describes as this masculine kind of monster, this muscular monster inside him kind of brewing like a volcano. Like there is a part of his body that knows, I don't like these people. I don't like this place, and I don't like who I am when I'm around them. I know, you know, the body knows that. Mm. But there was this desperate urge for him and for me at high school to kind of be like, well, I really want them to like, I really, I just want someone to like me and I just want someone to be my friend.
Yeah.
Which is pathetic, but it's also true. You know, like it's a very vulnerable thing to kind of admit that, you know, I'm so desperate for friendship that, you know, I will just totally play any part. If people want to make fun of me, you know, that's okay because at least they're talking to me.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of teenagers go through that. I think a lot of misfits, I think a lot of readers, you know, like kids who are readers, probably escape into books because it's a way out of that feeling.
Yeah.
So Leonardo was me kind of after high school. You know, I broke a lot of friendships. I broke a lot of family bonds. Yeah. I got away from a lot of people because I didn't, they weren't nice to me, you know, and there was no respect and there were no boundaries and there were so many things that were wrong. And it's not until you kind of find a way. For me, one of the most empowering things in my life has not been coming out in terms of sexuality, but it was a few years later when I kind of stood up for myself.
Yeah.
And was able to kind of go, I'm going to stand up for myself.
Yeah.
And if I had learned that at high school, if I'd learned how to assert myself, how to express myself, mm-hmm. how to have boundaries, how to not care what other people think.
Yep.
I would have loved to know that when I was 14 or 15, you know, instead of in my late 20s.
Yeah.
You know, if it was a subject, we should teach it, but, you know, you of can't course. Teach that.
No,
that's what books can do.
Well, that's right. I give the people who read them, you know, a role model to look up to before it's, you know, before they are in their mid-20s trying to work it out for the first time. But those scenes, particularly in the beginning where Leonardo's in the car and the others are bullying him essentially for what he was wearing. Oh, when he was wearing all those clothes, oh, my God, I could have just – I felt that in my – stomach. The my reaction to that was physical. I thought, oh, of course, like, oh my God, they're making, and they're so making so much fun. And as a teacher, I've seen that millions of times before. The quest to go over and beyond what is necessary to try and be accepted by others, only to have it get thrown back in your face. Oh man, you nailed that. That I felt that in my core and my being. He really felt
body cringe. Yeah. No, I wanted to lean into that. That was actually one of the hardest things to write of the whole book.
Really?
That part, yeah, because it's so cringe. Yeah. And I think everyone who's grown up in Australia, I don't know, maybe especially country towns, I'm not sure, but there is such a pressure to wear certain brands and the right brands of clothes. And like, if you didn't do that, you know, like, and so it's just so cringe to watch someone like Leonardo really try. He's really trying. He's doing his best, and just have everyone be like, "Not today, buddy. You are not getting away with this. We know you're a loser, and you're staying in your box."
It was awful. It was awful. I thought that was memorable. I think I read the scene out to my housemate and was like, "Remember this?" Because we were in the same thing, you know, shopping at surf. Like, I don't even like to swim. I don't like the beach, and here I am in my Billabong Roxy get up or whatever. Like, I've never, you know, my Hotmail email address is like Roxy Girl 14 at Hotmail or something. Like, I don't know anything about surfing. I am.
It's completely. It's a normal Australian experience, I think, and we just kind of normalize that. Okay, well, you got to wear those brands to be normal. Are you a surfer? No, but you know, people don't interrogate that unless you try to kind of do it too much.
I really felt that. But I liked at the end when Mason and Leonardo and Kaya, is that how you intend for that to be pronounced? Kaya? Be when they sort of lean into their true identities of who they actually are. And there's that scene where, you know, they've locked everyone in the shack and they're sort of seeking vengeance for the activities that have happened across the course of the previous days after they've been escaped from the toilet situation. And I thought I was so proud of them as characters, and I felt like I rushed the reading, but I sped through those chapters trying to get to the point where they realize that they have got something inside of themselves that they can stand up for themselves against all of these others, despite the whole Jared thing. But, you know, like stand up against everybody and get out of there and come to terms with who they are and what they want and what they're going to do. I was really invested in their stories, particularly I think in Mason's story. I think he was such a rich character, and I think, as I said, because I read Invisible Boys, and of course I really liked all those three of those characters too, and Mason I felt like had a lot of similarities with the three of them, and I was just so, you know, like when he's, I've forgotten the name of the other boy that's there, that he you know, they have a little relationship of some variety. What's his name?
Brayden.
Oh, thanks. You know, it's embarrassing when I'm talking to you about the book and I can't even remember the boy's name.
Well, he's a secondary character.
Yeah, right. Brayden. I should have guessed one of the Aidens. So Brayden is there. And when they finally got together, I thought, yes, this is fantastic. This is so great that he is, like, having this experience, and this is a formative experience for him, but also for Brayden and also for us and even for readers, like, reading it to, acquire a regular, like, that seems like a normal, everyday happening experience that people should read about, right? And I feel I mean, I've got lots of thoughts about the content of your books in terms of, like, what I know school people, teachers and librarians and stuff would say about the appropriateness of them for the classroom. And I just don't know. I've got so many thoughts. So I was reading this article about the Melbourne Writers Festival, and it was like, what are the key things we took away from the Melbourne Writers Festival? And I wrote down a quote, and I thought, I'm going to bring this up when I talk to Holden. And the question that they posed was, why are we disgusted when fiction represents things that happen in real life? And I thought, yeah, why are we? And I didn't even read what the person who had answered that question had said in whatever they were doing at the Writers Festival. But I thought, I think that is a perfect question, like an inquiry into why these kinds of texts might not be studied or picked or selected or promoted or focused on in the classroom, because they are excellent YA texts and they have so much in them in terms of the themes that are not just about sexuality, but there's so many things, as you said, mental health, masculinity, friendship, fitting in, coming of age, all that kind of stuff. But I feel like some people might fixate on the hot and steamy stuff that you put into the novels, and that would make it not appropriate, if you know what I'm saying.
I have had lots of conversations with teachers and heads of English and librarians, so none of this is new.
Yeah, I wouldn't have thought so. Yeah,
It's not new commentary.
Yeah,
But I like what you're saying, and I really like that quote. Well, it's just because I'm very much. I don't see myself as pushing boundaries. I think my work is in some way, but personally, I don't think, like, I'm not setting out to be like, oh, and I'm gonna shake things up by putting in sex, you know. Like, to me, I am writing the truth. I am writing what life is really like, and you know, like, pretty often, being 18 means there is sex, there is some form of drugs or alcohol. There's friendships falling apart. There's love. There's lust. There's so much going on. That's real.
Yep.
And teenagers are facing it. They're facing it from 14. They're facing it from 13, you know, in some form. They're coming up against this in real life. They don't necessarily want to have a conversation with their teacher. They don't necessarily want to have a conversation with their parents about it. We've lost a lot of, I don't know, I feel like my generation, kind of going back to being a teenager, say 15, 20 years ago, we had kind of these little, and I'm not talking even books. I mean, we had magazines. I know it sounds really weird, but that sounds weird now because the kids now just have the internet. but, you know, there was this kind of space where there were, you know, teenage magazines that girls would read that would deal with puberty and sex and all of that. But there were also this space, there was this space for them to talk about sex and to learn about sex and to learn about sexuality in all of those texts in a way that wasn't straight up porn and it wasn't the awkward conversation with the parent. And I feel like those spaces have been eroded / they've just completely disappeared. So we now have teenagers who are either learning a very kind of restrained textbook version of what's okay and what's not okay, or they're straight up watching porn and that's what sex is. And that's not real life. You know, like, that's not what real life looks like, and real relationships don't look like that. So I'm trying to do is probably fill that space that I feel has been eroded and just be like, this is real life. This is what teenagers go through. I feel like they have a right to know. I feel like they have a right to read about what they're going through already.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's a disservice if I in any way shy away from it. I'm not kind of going in, do you know what I mean? Going, I'm going to kick the hornet's nest. Yeah. I just feel like I'm going, this is what they're going through anyway. Let them read about it in a way with zero judgment, zero shame. Precisely. There it is on the page. They can make up their own minds about what they think of it.
Yeah, and I think when I was reading the text, I was thinking, this does feel like real and accurate based on, you know, the roles I've had in the classroom and the stuff that I hear about what kids are up to. Like, and I'm not an idiot in terms of, you know, what what they're doing. So it's good for them to be able to read and about those experiences. And I think maybe when I saw you at the Wheeler Center, you had spoken about how you had been involved with some like toxic situations or some situations and circumstances that were not great for you, and being able to write about the stories in the book from the perspective of the characters sort of helped you to unpack, in a sense, what had happened to you, but also shine a light on like this kind of behaviour is just straight up not cool for you. If you're in this situation, this is a way that you can navigate that. And I think that's an important thing.
And you're now at an age where this is part of your life.
Yeah.
And I think we've kind of lost that. And,
yeah.
and I think there is as well, literature is seen in such a different way to film or TV or video games. Mm-hmm. So if we look at like if we look at the creators of an MA 15 plus rated text, yep. like a TV show, video game, film, whatever,
mm-hmm.
no one looks at the director or the screenwriter and says, hey, you've got a responsibility to make sure this is appropriate for high school age children. Everyone goes, oh yeah, it's MA 15 rated. So, you know, it's going to be a bit full on.
Yeah. Right.
But 15-year-olds can handle that. But when you write a book that's yeah. pitched at 15 to 18-year-olds, people go, that's a bit hold inappropriate.
Yes.
And it's just a complete double standard. We seem to think that that literature needs to be pure or clean, and
yes.
it's the opposite of what it should be.
Well, right, like it's the sanctity of the written word or something that you can't, you know, you can't say certain things in text, but you can like show stuff on telly or whatever, which
to me is the other way around, because TV and film is graphic.
Graphic.
And,
yep.
and might actually kind of shock a 15-year-old who's naive.
Yep.
A book, you can only imagine what your head can imagine. So, like, do you know what I mean? There's only so graphic it can get.
Limited, exactly, based on your experiences. And if you've got nothing to go on, then you've got nothing to enhance your imagination. I think I just really think that there's, I don't know, like sometimes I read YA text, or I might watch something, you know, like Cheap and Cheerful on Netflix or something that's about young people, you know, whether it's like Never Have I Ever or that Heartstopper or whatever, which was based on the book series. And I think they're all doing great things, of course, but at the same time, I just kind of think it's a very, I don't want to say sanitized because that's not what I mean, but very like shiny version of how things might actually be. And this leads me to talk about just Invisible Boys real briefly, because I know that's being adapted for TV. So are you involved in the process of the adaptation? And will it be like a squeaky clean version of it? How will you keep the grit of that novel in the adaptation?
So I'll answer this, but I have to be development. Because we're in development at the moment, and the interesting thing about a TV series is that it stops being my thing. So, like, I can talk about a novel because I'm, you know, in that novel I am God, I am the boss, you know, like I'm the authority. I can say whatever I like about my current and future novels. But when I start talking about the TV series, obviously there's bigger things at play, and other people kind of own the rights. But yes, I am involved as a writer on the project, so I'm not involved in production. So, you know, people who message me asking for a role. I can't help you. you know, if you want a role as a cameraman, can't help you. nothing like that. But I'm just in the writing process. So I'm in the writer's room, and I get to be involved in, you know, writing the scripts, you know, co-writing some of the scripts.
Sure.
And that kind of
yep.
thing. And it's, you know, it'll be a 10-episode series. We've got Stan, the streaming service, it's in development with them, and we've got funding from ScreenWest and Screen Australia. So it's going really nicely. We're going into a market where things like Heartstopper, and I think sanitized actually is the correct word. We have these very squeaky clean sanitized versions of what male homosexuality should look like, often written by females. And, you know, that's not what my books do. My books are quite authentic. And I also don't have any problem with people writing outside their experience. You know, like, there is a whole genre of mostly female writers writing kind of male-male romances for mostly straight female readership, which is fine. Like, I have no problem with that. And things like Heartstopper are actually quite nice. I haven't read the graphic novel, but my husband and I watched the TV show and we kind of surprised ourselves by kind of going, you know, I actually quite like that. Like it's so the polar opposite to Invisible Boys in a lot of ways. but it was just really likable. It was a really nice, sweet thing.
Yeah.
But I think I have a problem with that being held up as a kind of aspiration for gay teenage boys to be like, hey, look, you know, maybe make some snow angels, you know, with your boyfriend. Like, I can tell you they're not making snow angels.
No. So not I just WA.
Sorry?
Not in WA.
Well, no, not in WA full stop, but I just there is this very squeaky clean version where it's kind of like it's about love only and never talk about the sex because that makes us squeamish. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm not a fan of that. And I see it as the same way as, like, you know, Disney rom-coms or, you know, Disney kind of princess things, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we can enjoy them as viewers for what they are. But if we saw anyone, especially these days, holding up, I don't know, Cinderella as like, hey, you know, straight teenage girls in 2022, this is what you should aspire to, you know, be a princess. And you know, like, everyone would just be like, what the hell? That is the worst role model you could be putting up.
Yeah.
And I feel the same way with Heartstopper and things like that. I mean, they're beautiful stories, they're lovely romances, and that's what they are. But if there is a push to kind of be like, gay boys, you ought to be like this, I would have a big problem with that.
Yes.
And I don't think that's what the author was doing, and I don't think that's what the show was doing. But no. I think sometimes there is a trend in, I don't know what part of the industry, but there is a trend to kind of look at these texts and go, that's aspirational, that's the kind of gay that we find acceptable. Yeah. And my books and my works will be probably pointing out that that's one thing and that's lovely and some people will love it. And there's also this, which is probably a little bit closer to reality, which is a bit grittier and a bit sexier. And certainly that's one of the reasons that Nick Verso, who's the director, that's one of the things he loved about Invisible Boys.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons he wanted to take it on.
Yeah.
Was to make a show, to make a show that is just as gritty and just as sexy as the book.
Cool.
So I don't think there's any, I don't think there's any risk of it becoming squeaky clean.
Well, no. I feel reassured by that, because that I think that would be a real shame if that was to lose some of that components of it. But I just want to pick up on what you just said about the, you know, presenting like sort of the one type of gay person that you have to present as and that you have to particularly be. Because in schools that I've worked in the past, we've tried to diversify our, you know, protagonists and cast of characters that we have across all of our books, regardless of what year they're in. But often we find, or often that I found in these experiences, we picked books or we had books that had gay characters in them, but their sexuality was always this like obstacle that they had to overcome. And sometimes it would end poorly, like for that particular character, or it was just sort of, and I'm not saying that I'm not, of course, saying that all experiences are like this, but generally there was a trend where if there was a gay character in a book, they had overwhelming mental health issues that were like resulting in them negatively, like harming themselves or attempting suicide and that kind of stuff. And I was really trying to fight back against just presenting being gay in that particular way, you know, that it's okay to be gay and not be like that, but it's also gay, fine to be gay and also have those experiences, but not everyone who is gay is going to want to end their life at some point or other. And if we keep choosing books that keep presenting that type of, you know, upholding that type of thing, people are going to start to wonder something about us if that's the message we're continually projecting. And I don't know where I was going with this question now that I've sort of half start baked this idea in my brain, but I just want to pick up on that thought that you had said, you know, the importance of honouring and valuing them multiple different ways, just like, you know, every other straight people, or people who identify as whatever they want to identify, right? It's not the same for everybody, so we've got to stop representing it in the one way.
100%. Like, that's exactly, and that's so important, and I think it needs to be said, and I think the industry is kind of getting there. Like, we're starting to open up, you know, that there's more than one way to be any letter of LGBT, but also just more broadly any identity full stop. We're getting kind of more interesting, nuanced representations in a lot of texts kind of this last decade compared to previously. And I think that's really important, because, you know, there'll be people who read, you know, there's gay guys who read Invisible Boys who, you know, I'm sure are kind of like, don't like it. You know, they probably don't contact me because they didn't like it. But, you know, I'm sure there'll be people who read it and go, that's not, you know, I don't vibe with that at all.
Yeah.
And that's really fine. But I get a lot of guys who do.
Yeah.
And so I think just the more own voices stuff we can put out there, you know, like, you know, get some gay men writing stuff, get some lesbian novels out there, get some trans novels out there that represent it from the experience of those people. Mm-hmm. And the more it's authentic, the more you have real people from that background writing about that background, you will get this multiplicity of, you know, we won't all agree. And that's a great thing. You know, I think there is a trend to kind of see LGBTQIA plus. And I'm, you know, I'm being a little bit flippant, but there is a trend to see that as this kind of umbrella where we all agree. And I think, well, no, we're a diversity,
of course,
not just of sexualities and genders, but we're a diversity of experiences and tastes and interests and political opinions. You know, like we have a huge spread. So I'd love to see text reflecting that your sexuality, your gender, whatever it is, they don't actually completely define you. There's a lot of difference among all of those letters.
Those things. How do you take your, you know, versions of yourself as a diverse person across with all your different interests and all that kind of stuff, speaking of diversity, and how do you section that into the voices that you pick for the text? So you've got the three in the Brink, but you've got some secondary characters. So like Jared, for example, we never hear Jared's point of view. But he is like the focus of at least two of the characters, sort of, you know, reason why they're there. And with Invisible Boys, you've got the other three really strong voices of those three boys. How do you section off your own interests and your own personality into those characters? And how do you write such strong voices for three different people?
They're all pretty much facets of myself.
Yeah.
And there was a version of The Brink where Jared did have point of view chapters and Val did as well.
Yeah.
But having five point of view was just
That's
way too much. It was just, it didn't work. So I pulled them out. But there was, you know, a version where I did get into the angry headspace of Jared and, you know, he's not happy. He's not a happy boy at all. So what I tend to do is just split myself into parts in both of these books. It was three parts.
Very and Voldemort of you, the Horcruxes.
Yes, they're my Horcruxes. Oh, I'm going to start using that. I've kind of gone because as well, I think I probably grew up feeling like, and this comes back to what we were saying about identity and stuff, but I grew up feeling like I'm a little bit of a geek, but then I was also a little bit of a punk. I was really into music. I was really into pushing back against authority and I was really angry. Yeah. And there's a part of me that really liked the gym and liked sports and was a bit of a jock, not necessarily good at sports, but liked it. And so all those things didn't feel like a real person. You know, like if they're all in the same person, it just sometimes the truth doesn't feel very believable, even in fiction. So I split myself into three instead and I kind of put those personalities and those attributes into those three boys. Mm-hmm. And the way I thought of it was parts of the body. So Zeke was the mind, Charlie was the heart, and Hammer was the jock. Hammer was the body. But then each of them had their kind of archetype. So Zeke was the nerd, Charlie was the punk, Hammer was the jock. And then each of them had like an attitude that I kind of assigned to them. And basically the way I did it was that I wouldn't think about the character being separate to me. If I was writing their character point of view, I was writing with their attitude word. So like Zeke's was like shy, and Charlie was angry and Hammer was cocky. And so if I'm writing a Hammer chapter, Hammer was my favorite to write because you could just be like, okay, how do I feel when I'm cocky? And like, what would I say if I was in this room? And I thought I was like God's gift. What would I say and how would I act? And so I just embodied them in a real, it was an embodied kind of sense.
Process.
Intuitively, how would I feel in those moments rather than making a character? That was the split. And then The Brink was quite similar, except they weren't parts of the body. They were things that I felt I couldn't be growing up. So Leonardo, I didn't feel like I could be tough or blokey. Kaya, I didn't feel like I was allowed to be bad or sexual. And, you know, Mason, I was not allowed to be homosexual specifically. So each of them reflect a part of my own journey that, again, I think if I put that into one character, it would just be chaos and there would be no clear storyline. And maybe as a book it wouldn't even work. So each of them instead has, a very clear aspect of stuff that I've gone through and we follow that in a more followable and palatable way.
I really was it not more challenging, because I'm think I don't know how to write anything, but in terms of, like, you know, Kaya is a female voice that I have not read from you. I mean, maybe in some journal somewhere you've got voices like that kept away that are not for public consumption, but this is the first time that I'd read you writing from a female perspective. And obviously people can write as they wish, what they wish. It's not here to badge you about that. I'm just wondering if the process of tapping into writing in that way, was it a different experience to embody Kaya as a girl and write from her perspective and how she might relate? Because I felt I liked her. She was sassy and quick-witted but like compassionate and considerate and like kind to Leonardo in particular. I really was looking forward to their friendship developing after the whole vomiting situation right from the get-go. Was it a different kind of way to get into writing her voice or not really?
Like, process-wise, not really. Like, it was the same thing. I just was kind of like, she's a human being. Yeah. Her gender does matter to some extent, but to some extent it doesn't as well. And, you know, she's just a teenager going through stuff with her family. And so I kind of put in, you know, in her is my own sense of, perfectionism, and that it wasn't okay to do the wrong thing. Yep. In my family, and that there would be some kind of retribution or punishment or opprobrium socially. So I know how to write that. And that was all real. So those parts of her are real. And the parts of her that are a little bit, you know, practical and maybe rude, you know, like, she's not great at holding Belle's hand and hugging her and saying, you know, and empathizing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I have, sometimes I'm not good at that, you know. Yeah. Like, sometimes,
yeah.
I've been that friend who's kind of like, okay, well, here's what we need to do to fix it, and, you know, someone will turn around and be like, I don't need you to fix anything. Can you just be a mate? Can you just, you know, or my husband, you know, would, you know, can you just hug me? You don't need to kind of put the hard hat on and fix everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, I know how that feels, and that part of Kaya is me.
Yeah.
So that's all kind of real. But I guess the thing I knew kind of going into it, like, I knew I was writing outside my experience.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to make sure I didn't fall into any of, like, really obvious cliches of male writer writing female character. So, you know, there's the very tropey thing of, you know, she breasted boobily down the stairs.
Yes.
And I was just absolutely adamant that, like, I don't want to do that. Like, I don't want to have a situation where it's about her body all the time or something like that. But I sometimes think I may have gone too far the other way, because I'm sure some level of having, you know, mentioned that she has breasts might have been appropriate. I think it might mention once. But no, so it was kind of like I was trying to avoid that. I was trying to just get to the essence of, she's a human being in the character. And I think I've just grown up with a lot of strong-willed females around me. I'm from a family of 6 kids, so... apart from having obviously a mum, the matriarch of the family, I've got 3 sisters.
Yeah.
I've grown up with them, with a lot of female cousins, very, you know, loud Italian cousins. Oh. You know, so I've seen those kind of female friendships unfold, and how, you know, teenage girls can be really loving and nurturing to each other, but then also, you know, they can turn. and they can pile on, and they can destroy someone they don't like.
Yeah.
And so I've seen it, and I've witnessed it, and I've kind of incorporated that. And I chatted to my sisters and cousins and my niece to kind of get a sense, because she was 18 when I was writing The Brink, and I was kind of like, what would you do? You know, like, how are girls mean at your age? And, you know, they're mean. God, they're so mean.
Yes.
So she gave me some really good insights. I think I just kind of went in going, look, I'll do as well as I can. I'm writing outside my experience the same way that, like, as I mentioned, a lot of straight female readers will write a gay teenage boy. And sometimes I read them and I can barely tell. And sometimes I read those books and I go, wow, you can really tell that this was written by a female who doesn't know anything about sex or how men feel. But it doesn't bother me. It's just, you kind of read it and you go, okay, well,
yeah,
they didn't quite get that right, but the proof's in the pudding, you know, it's not bad. And I kind of figured I would do the same here. You know, some people will read it and go, yeah, Kaya's not bad. Some people will read it and go, you can really tell a guy wrote this because Kaya would never do, you know, a girl would never do what Kaya does in chapter 20, whatever. And you just kind of live with that, you know, like you kind of, you live and you learn. And
well, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah. But so far, I mean, most of the feedback's actually been pretty positive about Kaya, which I'm really happy with.
Yeah, I wouldn't have hated her. Yeah, no, I don't, not at all. I wouldn't
have. And she is an anomaly, though. She, like, yeah, like what you were saying about are there journals where I've written, like, no. Like, mm-hmm. there's, I've never, she's the first time I've written first-person point of view from a female character. Yeah, character. And mm-hmm. I don't have any plans to do it again. You know, she just kind of cropped up in the middle of this story and she was angry and I thought she's got something to say and she said it.
Exactly. She did a great job. And I, you know, when I was preparing to talk to you about this, I realized that it's actually, there are so many characters in this book and some of them are like stick in your mind and they're quite memorable. The Mad Max kind of guy, the jet mm-hmm. ski situation at the end, or the swimming when he's trying to, Leonardo's trying to swim back. You know, there's some really key moments and I think, wowzers, like that's hectic. But how do mm-hmm. you, how, you said you had originally like the five voices that got culled down to the three. And maybe I'll just ask, how did you decide to cull Jared and Val? How were they the two that got, their voices were taken away out of the five of them?
I think that happened one at a time. So initially it was always three.
Yep.
And I think I read One of Us is Lying by Karen M. McManus,
okay,
which had four points of view.
Yes.
And so Val and Jared were in from the start, but they were not point of view characters. And I was like, maybe that's what this book needs. This is a terrible thing. This is why I no longer read as I'm writing. Because I read a book and I finish it and I go, that's what I need to do. I need to do something like that book.
Yeah.
And it's always a mistake. It's always a mistake to do that.
Yeah.
But that book had four point of view characters. And I was like, okay, maybe that's what's missing. Maybe it needs a vowel point of view.
Yeah.
So I wrote the vowel point of view. And then that went in and I was like, but it's weird now that we're in the troopy. We've got these four characters and then we don't see Jared's point of view at all. Okay.
Yep.
So I wrote another version where Jared was added in and to be honest, apart from it being just too much, like I read through that draft and I was like, this is five characters is way too much to hear from. But he was also very, very angry, very dark. And I think it was too much. Like you get enough of that from him just being in the room, like in the car, in the shack, on the beach.
Everywhere.
Jared's anger is enough just to have in the scene and to be in his head was too stifling. It didn't need it. And it also, both Jared and Val being point of view characters, just gave away too much without spoiling what happens in this book.
Mm-hmm.
If you can see from their points of view the whole way through, it starts to take away a bit of the tension and a bit of the mystery of who wants to be around who and who's done what. Mm-hmm. So I ended up deciding to, cull them both. And it was definitely the right decision.
Yeah, because there is a sense of, like, mystery about Jared in particular, about what's he reckon about what happened with him and Leonardo and, like, why are they like that and what does he actually think about Mason, and that you find it out eventually, right? But, yeah, I can see how including someone who's so, like, consumed with their own frustration, anger, whatever, about life in self would, bring everyone into it, right? You just don't need... that's my expert editing opinion, you know, that I'm offering up.
Your expert opinion is right. But, you know, with Jared especially, you know, that it was going into kind of trying to explain what happened between him and Leonardo, and it went into, it's not what is in the Brink now. It was, you know, a much darker story, and there was, it wasn't my story to tell. You know, I think that's the thing as well. Like Jared, it was bringing in a lot of abuse and a lot of violence, and I just kind of thought, you know, it's not what this story is. And having it be in one character's point of view, tackling these really, really huge things and then just skipping over to, you know, here's Mason, you know, wanting to have sex. it just wasn't right. It wasn't right at all. So it had to go.
That does seem would have been a disservice to both Mason's needs and also Jared's needs to just have them both coexisting in the same space. So I'm wondering... your thoughts on where you'd like the text, if it's going to be studied at school or available for kids in high school, where you think it might be most useful, or like what kind of conversations, I suppose, would you like this text to facilitate in a young person's life or in the school?
It doesn't come out kind of swinging against masculinity or shaming it, but it just opens the conversation up and for people to be curious and to talk about it in a kind of, in a relatively neutral way, I hope. So anything to do with masculinity, sexuality, sex, identity. And then kind of more generically, you know, friendships fitting in, growing up, family expectations, societal expectations. These are the kind of big overarching themes that a book like this could speak to. And I think it would be quite easy to pull passages from the book that speak to those things without the passage itself having to actually have some of that graphic sex in it.
What would you hope that someone who reads it takes from it? Like a one-sentence message or two?
I think I would like a reader to come away from reading The Brink and know that they are okay as they are and that it is possible to assert yourself and express yourself and stand up for yourself, and you don't need anyone else's approval. I think that is probably the biggest part of this book, is that there is a huge amount of anger, but that anger is about empowerment. It's about finding a way to be, say, this is who I am, I'm me, and I'm totally okay with it. Even if the world is not, I'm okay with it. That is something I would have liked to get my head around at 18. But it's a hugely valuable life lesson at whatever age we learn it, that we can survive without that approval, and life gets better once you are living on your own terms.
That's very true. If you could hand a teenager one book to read right now, what would that book be? It can be your own, obviously, but if you had another.
The Brink by Holden Shepherd, available now.
I've heard of it.
The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho.
Probably. I was going to say, I think you should say The Alchemist.
Well, it's just about following your dream. And I think at the age, when you're a teenager, there are a lot of voices around you telling you what to do or what you ought to do. And there are very few voices saying, what do you want to do? You know, and without expecting an answer, just being like, hey, what do you, you know, go explore it. Go find out what you want. And I feel like a book like that actually is a voice that says it's okay to dream big, even if you come from, even if you're a little farm boy in Spain, you know, in The Alchemist, you know, you can dream of treasure in Egypt and you can walk all the way to the pyramids and, you know, go for it. And I think there are not enough voices that tell kids to do that. I think there are a lot of voices that say, go get a big boy job, get a degree, get a trade.
Make some money.
There's enough voices to say, go do something big with your life and have fun.
That's very true, actually. All right, if you are a young adult person and or a teacher of young adults, are there any texts that can be books or music or film or TV that you would recommend for young adults to view or their teachers that might like to view? Anything that's up there on the list of things that you think they should be familiar with?
There was a really good book that came out from Penguin 2018 called Stone Girl by Eleni Hale. And that deals with some really serious stuff about being a ward of the state. But also falling into, it's like being neglected and there's drug use and it's quite heavy. It's usually my touchstone for other books that have been, you know, gritty and past muster, you know. And so I always recommend that as an Aussie YA text. So I love that. My own books, obviously. anything by, say, Tobias Madden. He's got some really good gay texts, kind of, you know, not quite rom-coms, but kind of leaning in that direction. They're a little bit lighter, but they're also quite real and they're very Aussie. And they're set in Ballarat, which I just think is really cool. That there's some kind of country rep. Gary Lonesborough's book, The Boy from the Mish. Aboriginal.
I've interviewed Gary in a similar fashion, actually, about...
Oh, you have?
Yeah, we had a great chat.
He's a really cool guy, really nice guy. And, I cover-quoted his book, he cover-quoted my book.
I was going to say, his name's on the front cover over here.
But it's great when you find people who are doing similar stuff in the YA space specifically. Miranda Luby's got a really great book out. I'm reading at the moment, yes, called Sadie Starr's Guide to Starting Over, which is about perfectionism and kind of maybe cancel culture at a high school level.
Yes.
So those are the kind of texts that I think are going around now.
Yeah.
And I'm deliberately choosing texts that are current because, as you say, I think my husband works as an English teacher,
mm-hmm.
As well as being an author and a YouTuber. He does a lot of things. But he has, you know, worked with a lot of teachers who are like, you know, we've got a lot of these classics, but what's new?
Yes.
And so he's often, because he's in the Love Oz YA kind of, he's aware of that nice. World. He's kind of going, there's all these books. And so I'm trying to do the same thing as well. With,
yeah, cool.
You know, and probably what you're doing as well with this podcast mm-hmm. is saying that there's all these Aussie YA voices that are out there and we would be great for a classroom. We would be great to have really modern conversations about a whole yes. range of stuff with Absolutely. Teenagers.
That's very true. And I've got two more questions before I bid you farewell. Firstly, what are you reading right now? What's on your bedside table, if you have one?
I do have a bedside table. And I did just mention one. So I'm about 40 pages into Sadie Starr's Guide to Starting Over from Miranda Luby. Mm-hmm. I also just started, just before that, before my book tour started, I started reading The Great Gatsby because I have never read it. And there's actually, and I'm actually going to go into doing a bit of that. I've never read a lot of the classic kind of 20th century literature and which is, I've kind of been able to get away with it. And I could get away with it forever if I wanted to. But I'm now writing my third book, which is for adults. And I really want to do some time where I read and read a little bit more widely into adult literature and get a handle on what I might like to say and you know, hopefully learn from some of these really great masters.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's what's kind of coming up next for me.
That's my next question. Are you working on anything now? An adult text. Or text for adults, maybe not adult text, but
I know it sounds, yeah. Just,
maybe it will be.
Well, you know, it is a Holden Shepherd book, so maybe. No, it won't be that graphic. Well, it might be graphic, but it will be for adults for sure. You know, whether or not it can, I think, it, well, who knows? I haven't kind of finished it yet.
Yeah.
I finished the second draft, but there's still lots of rewriting to be done. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how school appropriate this one might be. But the one that comes after it is going to be hopefully a sequel to Invisible Boys.
Oh.
So, yeah, that might be my fourth book. So that would be, again, there'll be adults in that book, but I think it will translate to a teachable text, hopefully. But, yeah, this third one is contemporary fiction for adults. It's a character who's kind of angry, gym junkie, alcoholic, you know, Italian. Can't tell you who he's based on.
I don't know anyone. I've certainly had an hour or so talking to someone who may or may not.
I've never heard of this man in my life. It's about being 30. It's about adult loneliness. Actually about adult male loneliness, maybe specifically. And family and all kinds of things. So it'll be interesting to see how it kind of shakes out. But it's still early days and I've really decided I don't want to rush this book. You know, Yeah, there are 3 years between Invisible Boys and The Brink,
mm-hmm.
and I don't want to be a novel a year kind of writer. I just don't think I can do it.
Yeah, sure.
So I'll be percolating this book and reading and thinking and researching and then coming back to it for a third draft.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. I'm so grateful, Holden, to talk to you today, this morning, this afternoon. We've now across time zones, across time and space, made it happen about The Brink. Mm. I'll make sure that the people who are listening get access to the teacher's notes, your website, where they can buy the book, all that kind of stuff, and I'll make sure that people are well stocked with sources for how they can teach The Brink and or Invisible Boys in the classroom. So
I'm excited. Perfect.
That was great. Thank you so much.
Look, thank you. I didn't even notice the time going by. Emma, that was really great. So sincerely, thank you so much.
No worries. My pleasure.